Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear about the gearing up of the war against Islamic State.
The point is, ISIL leaders cannot hide, and our next message to them is simple: you are next.
Our Istanbul correspondent reports on tensions between Russia and Turkey. We'll consider the ups and downs of oil prices. And who will headline this year's Super Bowl game is right here on the Voice of America. The international community is trying to form a strategy in the fight against Islamic State. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, hello, Susan. Saudi Arabia has announced the formation of a 34-nation Islamic counterterrorism coalition based in Riyadh that includes Arab nations such as Egypt, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Malaysia, Pakistan, as well as several African states. The U.S. has called on Gulf Arab allies to do more to combat the IS threat in Syria and Iraq. The announcement came as President Obama once again Monday sought to reassure Americans that his administration is committed to the fight against the IS group in the wake of the Paris and San Bernardino, California attacks. The president, speaking after a national security meeting at the Pentagon, said the U.S. is hitting the IS group harder than ever.
Coalition aircraft, our fighters, bombers, and drones have been increasing the pace of airstrikes, nearly 9,000 as of today. Last month, in November, we dropped more bombs on ISIL targets than any other month since this campaign started. We're also taking out ISIL leaders, commanders, and killers, one by one. We're going after ISIL from their stronghold right in downtown Raqqa to Libya. The point is, ISIL leaders cannot hide, and our next message to them is simple: you are next. Every day, we destroy, as well, more of ISIL's forces, their fighting positions, bunkers, and staging areas, their heavy weapons, bomb-making factories, compounds, and training camps. In many places, ISIL's lost its freedom of maneuver because they know if they mass their forces, we will wipe them out. In fact, since this summer, ISIL has not had a single successful major offensive operation on the ground in either Syria or Iraq.
Mr. Obama did not announce any new initiatives, although he does insist the current campaign against the IS group is being intensified. Terrorism analyst Max Abrams of Northeastern University in Boston told me that this is the second public statement the president has made about the fight against the IS group in 2 weeks, reflecting what he sees as intense political pressure to do something new in the wake of the global IS threat.
The Republican field is really having field day against Obama, saying that he's sort of a do-nothing president, that he really doesn't have a strategy, that he's clinging to the status quo, even though it's really not working. Polls indicate that national security, especially the terrorism threat, is the number one concern now among American voters. And right after Obama said that Islamic State had been contained, there was that attack in San Bernardino, California, which only underscores the fact that far from being contained, Islamic State's theater of operations continues to expand. Last week, Obama gave a speech essentially summarizing the achievements of the White House against Islamic State, but it fell flat. And so I think today that speech was a bit of a do-over, but frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of new content.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you, that like his Oval Office address about a week ago, the president Monday offered no shift in policy.
I mean, in all of these announcements, we're waiting for new information. We're looking for a change in our basic strategy because everybody knows that the campaign against Islamic State is not going smoothly. Now, sure, by a number of indicators, the Islamic State threat is being reduced. It is true, as the president pointed out, that the territorial control, both in Iraq and in Syria, is smaller. It's also true that there have been 9,000 aerial bombs dropped on the group, and that we've managed to take out a number of their leaders. And so all of these things are true, including the fact that we are now really going after the group's financial infrastructure in eastern Syria in terms of its oil-selling capabilities. And yet, over the past few months, the world has seen Islamic State attacks over the Sinai in Egypt, in France, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in the United States, in Nigeria, in Yemen, in Afghanistan. We're looking for more evidence of progress, or at least an indication that we're on the right path. And without some sort of change in strategy, I don't think that the American public will be very placated.
And Max Abrams says he welcomes the new Saudi-led Muslim coalition, reminding him of the rise of moderate Sunnis in Iraq during the U.S.-led invasion that took on al-Qaeda-linked fighters. He says up to now, the Arab response against the Islamic State has been disappointing.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
This story is, of course, making news on the web. One site is, Obama, ISIS, you are next. Topsy.com says there were about 280 reports using that phrase in the past day. At that site, there are a number of messages against Obama, and some of them are a little vulgar. I won't mention them, but Renee Nichols at Alan Colmes write, so tired of you saying that Obama taking back from ISIS. If true, how can they hit other countries? And maybe we are next. Rick Baker says the so-called Obama JV team, ISIS, just issued a statement, America, you are next. Bill Solomon tweets, ISIS is already here. Thanks to Obama, they are just waiting to acclimate and then arm themselves, and you know next. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. VOAnews.com reports both officials said the crisis in Syria, the Islamic State, and the unrest in Ukraine would be focal points during their meeting in Moscow today. Also trending is today's Republican U.S. presidential candidate debate. Harrods.com writes, Donald Trump at center stage, but Ted Cruz in spotlight at Republican debate. The USA Today headline reads, six things to watch at the Las Vegas Republican debate. Those include Donald Trump and the ISIL threat, who takes on Trump, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz, ready or not. Rocky Mountain Bike tweets, the next Republican debate will be called Islamophobia Palooza. And also trending, according to Google News, is Serena Williams. The Los Angeles Times writes, are fans right to be upset that Serena Williams beat American Pharoah for Sports Illustrated's Sports Person of the Year? A Times headline reads, seven things we learned about Serena Williams from Sports Illustrated. Those include, back in 2005, Serena and Venus Williams starred in their own reality show, Venus and Serena for Real. Both Venus and Serena Williams are part owners of the Miami Dolphins, and she has competed in three Olympic Games and won four gold medals. And USA Today writes, Serena Williams won Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year award this week, a recognition for her stunning season that saw her come just short of winning the Grand Slam. She was by far the most dominant player in women's tennis at age 34, and she is a worthy choice for the award. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A couple of months ago, the internet buzzed with a rumor that a massive structure built by an advanced civilization of extraterrestrials might be orbiting a star located nearly 1,500 light years from Earth. Erratic dimming of a star known as KIC-846-2852 has baffled astronomers since its September discovery by citizen scientists. SETI international researchers at the Bocate Optical SETI Observatory in Panama search for laser pulses from the star, but anyone hoping for evidence of an ET will be disappointed. SETI International says they did not find any evidence of an advanced civilization beaming intentional laser signals toward Earth. Periodically dimming star is often seen as an indication of an exoplanet, but the dimming pattern around the newfound star was sporadic and irregular. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Over the weekend, a Russian warship fired warning shots against a Turkish fishing boat, the latest sign that bilateral tensions continue to grow. Dorian Jones is following that story from Istanbul and joins us on the line. Hello, Dorian.
Hello.
Please tell us about this latest incident.
Well, Moscow is claiming that its destroyer that was in the Aegean Sea was approached by a Turkish fishing boat, and despite repeated hailings, it carried on its course and was forced to open fire at the boat, and using also a number of flares and things. No one was injured or hurt. I mean, interestingly, though, the captain interviewed has said that he didn't even hear any shooting or firing and has denied the incident took place. But this does highlight that despite efforts on Turkey's part, at least, to defuse these tensions with Moscow, relations still remain very, very tense. If anything, they are getting tenser.
Well, meanwhile, Ankara is working to end its energy dependency on Russian gas. Could you tell us about that?
Well, yes. I mean, ever since the downing of a Russian bomber by Turkish jets last month, Turkish diplomats and political leaders have been crisscrossing the region looking for alternative energy supplies. Turkey imports around 55% of its natural gas from Russia, and they are very keen now to diversify that dependence. They've been visiting Qatar, a key ally. They signed a deal for liquefied natural gas. At the same time, the prime minister was in Baku, capital of Azerbaijan, looking for potential supplies from Azerbaijan as well. And I think all these moves do indicate that there is this realization on Ankara's part that there will be no return anytime soon to the rapprochement and warm relations between Moscow and Ankara. They do definitely appear to be preparing. This is going to go on for a long time to come. Although analysts are pointing out it is going to be extremely difficult for Turkey to diversify quickly on Turkey, on its dependence on Russian energy.
And what is complicating that process?
Well, a number of factors. One is it does take a long time to build the infrastructure to link up to other suppliers. Also, Turkey is beholden to contracts to the Russian supplier Gazprom, something in the region of 3 years. If it breaks those contracts, it will be liable for massive penalties. So that is also another key problem. And another factor is it doesn't have the infrastructure to support large imports of liquefied natural gas. There's been criticism that Turkey's government has been too dependent on Russia. In spite of warnings in the past, Ankara has chose to ignore them, and now people are saying Turkey finds itself in a very difficult position, especially this winter, because the fear is Moscow could do what it did to Ukraine. It could say there are technical problems, and it will stop supplying gas to Turkey for 2 weeks, and Turkey only has 2 or 3 days of natural gas supplies to sustain itself, so it is in a tight situation.
Are there any words about getting this situation calmed down?
Well, Turkey is working very hard to try to defuse this. I think there's a realization that it is finding itself in a very difficult situation with Moscow. Russia is a regional superpower. It has a lot of influence, not only with many of Turkey's southern neighbors, Iraq, also Iran. There's this feeling that there is this growing alliance between Moscow and Tehran against Ankara. And added to the fact you've got Turkey has a number of outstanding potential tensions in the Caucasus, Armenia-Azerbaijan tensions. Turkey's a player in that. Georgia, another place. And also the Dagestan-Chechnya. Moscow has a lot of outstanding concerns with Ankara over its alleged claims of support that Ankara is giving to Islamist rebels. There are a number of host of issues that tensions could erupt between Moscow and Ankara on a number of fronts. And let's forget, Ankara and Moscow have had centuries of tensions in this region, and there is a concern now that with this new tension between Moscow and Ankara, all these tensions across the region can erupt and put Ankara in a very difficult position.
Thank you very much, Dorian, for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Coming up on International Edition, a look at the movements in world oil prices. And Coldplay is playing the big game. Traders continue to expect downward pressure on oil prices for the foreseeable future, although the prospect of higher U.S. interest rates could reverse the trend of 7-year lows. Monday, the price of oil hovered around $36 a barrel, although it fell below $35 a barrel in New York. Prices have fallen over 60% since June of last year. Carl Larry is an engine energy analyst with the Alexandria, Virginia-based consulting firm Frost & Sullivan. He notes a number of factors affecting the market, including an oil glut, slowing economies, mild weather, and technological advances, such as the extraction technique of hydraulic fracturing or fracking.
I think the fracking has helped America become oil independent, and that's a really big deal. And with that independence, what's happening is that we're seeing the economy rally and the dollar rally behind it, and that's causing this overall effect where we're seeing oil prices lower, but again, American oil dependence really waning.
Will the oil glut continue?
Well, I think that the manufacturers, the producers have to cut back at some point. The big deal here is that America has become independent on making our own oil, and what we have done is pushed back all the imports that we were getting. All those imports that we pushed back add up to about 4 million barrels a day, and that's where that glut's coming from. You combine that with the decline of the economy in Europe, the decline of the economy in China, and now you have a really big problem. So the producers will have to cut back.
There is concern that the U.S. Federal Reserve will raise interest rates, also affecting the price of oil.
You know, this has a really big impact on oil. What happens is that the value of the dollar goes higher, and since oil is priced in dollars, it means that it's going to decline because it's going to really decrease the buying power of everybody outside of America. What you have here now is a very expensive American oil, but a very, very poor demand for American oil outside of here. And as long as the barrel is based in U.S. dollars, that's going to put a lot of pressure on oil outside of America.
And Carl Larry says the long term, the push to reduce the use of fossil fuels will be a deterrent to increasing refinery production and the search for oil. But in the near term, he says, it will remain the cheapest way to access energy, especially for fragile economies. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
Most electric cars need a charge after just 300 or 400 kilometers, but not the new fuel cell vehicles like Hyundai's iX35, which powers its electric motor with hydrogen. Hyundai recently showed off its newest model on nearly every street in London. Laura King is Senior Manager of Public Relations.
So we've driven, photographed and filmed every single street in central London, as defined by the world famous Cabby Knowledge. And that's actually over 2,000 miles.
The iX35 can reach a maximum speed of 160 kilometers per hour. Here's Robin Hales of Hyundai.
The only difference between this and an electric car is that this produces its own electricity on board, so it doesn't need to be plugged in.
Hyundai's iX35 fuel cell holds the record for the longest trip on a single tank of hydrogen. Hydrogen fuel stations, though, are far and few between. Only about a dozen stations in the United States have hydrogen, nearly all of them in California. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
One of the biggest annual music events is seen by about a billion people around the world, and it only lasts for about 15 minutes. It's the U.S. National Football League Super Bowl halftime show. This year, there is an added buzz because it is the 50th Super Bowl. Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins VOA's Jim Stevenson to talk about the headline act.
This is the golden anniversary Super Bowl, the 50th Super Bowl. So the National Football League is going to go all out. We now know who the headliner for the halftime show will be. It will be the English rock band Coldplay.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, Bruno Mars was the early favorite. And in fact, Bruno is going to be involved in this show. And you might remember he put on a killer halftime show in 2014,
right,
along with his special guest, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Well, the Latin Times reports that Bruno will curate this Super Bowl 50 halftime show, and I take that to mean that he will likely perform, and he will also bring a bunch of big-name guest stars. Now, Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, is good friends with Jay-Z and Beyoncé. Beyoncé, of course, was the headliner at the 2013 Super Bowl.
Right.
So she's got plenty of Super Bowl experience.
And some accused her of knocking the lights out in that game.
Yeah, well, you know, there is that possibility. And Beyonce also shows up on Coldplay's brand new seventh album, A Head Full of Dreams. So if you put everything together, I think a clearer picture emerges of what we can expect. Super Bowl 50 happens on February 7th, 2016 at Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. For the past few years, this has been the trend with Super Bowl halftime shows, multi-artist extravaganzas.
The NFL, in the wake of the Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction, likes to have these things tightly choreographed.
Well, they've loosened up a bit. You might remember that immediately in the wake of the 2004 wardrobe malfunction, they had a series of classic rock artists, people like Paul McCartney and Tom Petty. Prince was in there. They would be what you might call safe choices. Mm-hmm. Well, Coldplay is a safe choice, too. Most likely, they had Katy Perry last year. It's going to be a real extravaganza, though. I think they're going to pull out all the stops for this one. I think Coldplay will sort of be the eye of the hurricane, so to speak.
Absolutely. And they love to also have a lot of acts before the game as well for the fans. If you actually go to the game, there's a lot going on musically.
Yeah, they've come a long way. The earliest Super Bowls had college marching bands
right.
for their halftime entertainment.
Right. And who could forget Up With People?
Up With
yes,
People.
They did a couple halftime shows.
Way back in the 70s.
Yes.
I think the age of the modern Super Bowl halftime show began in 1993 when Michael Jackson was the feature performer.
I remember that one, and that was quite a spectacular. You can see that on YouTube, by the way, and, right. and looking at the old footage, wow, it's still a big halftime show.
Still holds up, and mm-hmm. things have never been the same since then.
Things that hold up here always is our Top 20 Countdown. We love to hear it every week. Ray McDonald is our host. Follow him on Twitter as well, Ray.
Ray on the hits.
That's all you need to know. Thanks for stopping by.
You got it, Jim.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the Helsinki Final Act marks its 40th anniversary, it is critical that all members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe remain faithful to its core principles. These principles include recognizing the inherent dignity and human rights of every person, respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every participating state, and refraining from the threat or use of force across the OSCE region. In light of these commitments, the United States renews its call for Russia and the separatists that it backs to fully implement the Minsk agreements to which Moscow is a signatory. This includes the removal of Russian forces and equipment from eastern Ukraine and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has emphasized the importance of the Minsk agreements provision for local elections in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to be carried out under Ukrainian law and subject to monitoring by the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. There must also be a return to Ukrainian control of the border and the release of all hostages detained for politically motivated reasons. Meanwhile, Ukraine needs to do its part by withdrawing its heavy weapons and to negotiate in good faith the Donbas election procedures. This is a time for concrete steps, said Secretary Kerry at the recent OSCE ministerial meeting in Serbia, and to avoid what is a disastrous but unnecessary conflict, and to begin the process of rebuilding Ukraine's east. Elsewhere in the OSCE, protracted conflicts continue in places like Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria, Georgia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. The protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms throughout the OSCE region continues to be a priority. In too many countries, said Secretary Kerry, non-governmental organizations are being restricted by new laws. Journalism is under attack, and the freedom of expression, including the media, is in jeopardy, sometimes by threat of force. There is no acceptable excuse for abusing the rights of citizens, for preventing journalists from doing their jobs, or from silencing legitimate political dissent. I hope that we will all reaffirm these fundamental ideals, said Secretary Kerry. The enduring promise of Helsinki should inspire all of us to tackle these shared challenges with renewed urgency and to continue our efforts in building a Europe and a Eurasia that is whole and free and at peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.